This is the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Thanks so much for listening. About 10 years ago, I read a book called Freakonomics. It was written by an economist named Stephen Levitt and a writer by the name of Stephen Dubner. And it's one of my favorite reads of all time. And I started following everything else these guys were doing. I read their follow-up book, Super Freakonomics. The one after that, Think Like a Freak. I've read their blog online, listened to a couple of their Freakonomics podcasts. And now I'm reading their new book, When to Rob a Bank, and 131 more warped suggestions and well-intended rants. And one of the authors is joining me here today, Stephen Dubner. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. My pleasure, Paul.
I mentioned that I'm a big fan of Freakonomics and have been, and have been reading the blog all along. And I notice a couple of themes here through the years. And one of the themes is how bad Americans, or let's just make it people in general, are at risk assessment. And one of the themes that you write about frequently is how we make bad decisions because we're afraid too often, right?
That is absolutely right. I mean, and it's not, I mean, fear is, we get fear as humans, you know, we're animals that evolved certainly under circumstances where we had to be scared of a lot of stuff. But part of the problem is we're still scared of a lot of things that our ancestors needed to be scared about and we don't. But additionally, we are often really scared of the wrong things. So if you look at, you know, the way people invest, if you look at the way people respond to crime or terrorism, you find that the opportunity cost of being scared is really high. I'll give you one example. We have one blog post that we published in this book called The Cost of Fearing Strangers. And, you know, I'm a parent. I'm sure many of your listeners are parents. We've all been children, and we know that it's kind of drilled into us that, you know, parents make their children kind of frightened of a lot of things. You know, don't walk too close to the road, don't talk to any strangers, and so on. And it turns out that one theme that's really common, not just for kids but for adults, is that we really think that there's just this army of people that we don't know who are out to do us harm. They're out to steal our money, they're out to hurt us, and so on. Now, is it true that this happens? Of course it happens. But the proportion is so much less than we think. So if you look at the data, which is what we do with Freakonomics, on crimes like money crimes, on violent crimes, and so on, kidnapping, you'll find that the vast majority of said crimes are carried out not by some stranger, but by people we know.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that, you know, one of the most costly things you can do is be suspicious of everything and everybody in the world, because that really constrains the way that you carry out your life. So it's true. We humans are, look, we're a great species, Paul. I like humans a lot. Some of my best friends are humans.
Yeah.
We also spend a lot of time worrying about things that are not worth worrying about so much, and conversely, we probably should pay more attention to some things that that might affect us in the future that we don't. You know, nutrition is an easy example. We worry about things like you know, terrorism and violent crime and so on, but the fact is that the vast majority of people are going to end their lives prematurely by just not taking very good care of themselves.
Right.
That's something that you control entirely.
And unfortunately, fear not only drives public policy, but is used by people in power to influence what we think so that we will vote for them or think that they're making the rational choices. And I'm thinking predominantly of the security theater that is the TSA at our airports. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would. That is so true, especially with the first part of your statement. I mean, politicians, look, here's the thing. Somebody asked me this the other day, you know, they said, I dread the next presidential campaign because we're going to see all these TV ads and other ads where one candidate tries to scare you into voting for them by saying that the other candidate will do something terrible or stupid or mean. And they said, you know, what can we, you know, how are we supposed to weather this storm? Because obviously they have determined that fear tactics work. And my response to that is, I don't think we know that fear tactics work. I've never seen data on whether that kind of TV ad is actually effective. My guess would be it's actually not effective. The fact is, a lot of things happen in society, they evolve that way, and then we accept the fact that they must be, you know, effective or optimal. I would love to see a new brand or breed of politician that talks a little bit more rationally, a little bit more like an economist. You know, for whatever reason, America has never really latched on to the idea of having people with a background in economics or even political science really in politics. Many other countries, I mean, the prime minister or president of many other countries have been economists who, and what they're pretty good at is using data to sort out the real from the kind of hype or the hyperbole. And we just don't, for whatever reason, we don't do that. So I think that's the direction we need to move in. It wouldn't solve all problems, but it would really help if you could have politicians talk and say, you know, I understand why everyone got very upset about this event that just happened, this terrible event, whether it's a natural disaster, a terrorist attack, whatever. But you have to understand the probability and even the loss of that event, while tragic, represents less than 0.1% of the bad events that are prevented every day by doing X, Y, and Z. And so we should spend our energy and our resources on that. We should improve our infrastructure. We should improve our transportation, our education, our healthcare. Those are the kind of long-term complex problems that we want our politicians to solve, but they're so busy addressing the noisy stuff that scares us that they don't really do it.
And to be honest, I had to keep myself from bursting out laughing. You used the word rational and candidate in the same sentence. So let's move on to something else that you've written about, and that is America's fear of quitting.
It's true. I think that, look, I grew up in a very traditional rural family. I was the last of eight kids, and I got the same message that most everybody in America in my generation got, which was a winner never quits and a quitter never wins, right?
Yep.
And I think there's obviously a lot to be said in favor of that statement. However, there's a lot to be said in opposition to that statement, too, and here's what I mean. If we are so devoted to never quitting or abandoning or changing anything because we think it shows a kind of moral failure, then what you're going to do is you're going to have millions of people stuck in jobs, in mindsets, in relationships, and whatever that are just not very good for them. And so if you think about it a little bit more like an economist would and think about the notion of opportunity cost, that is, for every hour I spend doing something or every dollar I spend on something, that's a dollar or hour I can't spend on something else. That's what opportunity cost is. And so I think it's really a healthy, good thing for many people to think about, you know, I've stuck with this thing, whatever it is, a project, a job, maybe even a relationship for a long time because I'm scared to quit. I don't want to be looked at as a failure. But you know what? What would happen if I did? Might I do better for myself, for my family, for my society? And so we really do believe in the upside of quitting, absolutely.
Well, then what do you say to the boyfriend of the woman who wrote to you recently on your blog and said, because of what you wrote about quitting, I broke up with my boyfriend?
Here's the thing. I think that if someone reads what we write and decides that thinking about quitting in a new light is enough to make them break up with a boyfriend, then that was definitely not the appropriate boyfriend for them. So I would say to the boyfriend, I'm sorry, but you know what? It wasn't going to be a good fit anyway, and I'm glad it's working out better.
You're saying it doesn't matter whether it was in a book or on a blog or anywhere else. There was something at the root of the relationship that was troublesome enough to begin with that we were just the little pebble that knocked it over the edge.
That's absolutely right. That's the perfect way to put it, yeah.
All right, 30 seconds to go here. True or false, there's no such thing as home field advantage.
Not true. There is home field advantage, but it has much more to do with referee bias, even if it's unconscious or subconscious bias, rather than all the stuff about home cooking, knowing the court better, and so on. It's really about the crowd and the environment affecting referees in a way that gives them a little bit more incentive to give the home team a better call.
So players don't play better at home or worse on the road?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. If you separate out all the different events, all the different elements that might comprise home field advantage, the only one that really holds water is referee calls. Yep.
Steven, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Congratulations on the new book, and thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thanks so much, Paul. Really enjoyed it.
Stephen J. Dubner is co-author with Stephen D. Levitt of all the Freakonomics books. Their newest is called When to Rob a Bank and 131 more warped suggestions and well-intended rants. And before you ask, the answer to the question, when should you rob a bank, is never. Don't rob a bank. It's not a good idea. There's no time or day that's better than any other. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.